Welcome to the Metaphysical Martini Show, where wit and wisdom come together to bridge the gap between the spirit realm and the physical world.
With Ani Avedisian, the Mad Shaman, a production of CosmicReality.com.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ani Avedisian. Welcome to Metaphysical Martini. Three parts spirit, one part rational mind. Add two drops of optimism. Give it all a good hard shake and pour. Dress it with the olives of grace and empathy. Sit back, sip slowly, and contemplate the wonder of cosmic co-creation. And a hearty hello to everyone out there. Hello, hello, hello. Thanks for joining me for yet another round of cocktails on this week's Metaphysical Martini, the show that tries to sort out what's true, what's woo, and what gets flushed down the loo. In a world so horribly mixed up and upside down, even the pretty people wear a frown. A word that just once gorged on feeble minds and warped designs, but now vomits its obsolescence from the sidelines. A world about to explode with so much divine light, people might actually forget what it means to fight. And even better than that, and then some, I think John Bolton's going to get it right up the bum. Oh, come on, everyone, when are we going to see some perp walks? Let's open Pandora's box. Let's send all the corrupt cowards who dared mess with the American dream on a nice long holiday to the Cuban YMCA. And why not leave them there forever and a day? Oh, it's time to hear some of that Nessun Dorma. Come on, baby, play the song. I feel the ramping up, don't you? You know, Kash Patel, who normally looks like he's a deer in the headlights, he's got a twinkle in his eye that wasn't there before. Pam Bondi's a little bit more relaxed. Everybody's a little bit more chill. I think it's going down, people. You know, Nessun Dorma. What does it mean? Nobody shall sleep. No one shall sleep. Even you, O princess, in your cold room, watch the stars that tremble with love and with hope. But my secret is hidden within me. My name no one shall know. No. And he goes on about, my kiss will dissolve the silence that makes you mine. Vanish, O night. Set, O stars. At dawn, I will win. I will win. All'alba vincerò, vincerò. That was towards the end of a great movie called The Sum of All Fears, where presidents are sitting and signing little pieces of paper, but in the background, all the bad guys of the deep state are getting exactly what they deserve. They wake up the next day somewhere else, not on this realm. But I digress, because the question that keeps us all guessing is, what's up with all this weird Russian dressing? You know, I know, and you know, that T and P are best buds. And even though, you know, they're both a little too macho to call it a bromance, and I suspect what's happened is they've had a little tiff over whether or not Big Bad Bibi would honor any deals to do with peace. And the answer to that, of course, is not. You see, here's the problem Bibi has with Trump's peace plan. Here's the problem many people have with Trump's peace plan. Bad people don't want peace. Of course they don't, because they are demonkin. And demonkin who wish to control the world want chaos, so they can rape and pillage every village to their calcified heart's content. And as we have all learned all too well, demonkin have lots of money. And given the correct amount of money, almost all human relationships can be altered. Oh, human race, you have failed yourself. Oh, before we get too depressed, hello, Welcome to the show. What do we have for you on today's show? Let's see. Well, we usually begin with Quack, questions, answers, and comments. That's where you, the people, can talk about whatever it is that you want to know and discuss it with martini heads all over the world. And we usually follow that with a tiny pat of poetry, usually something I've written that I'm trying to make you read on Substack. And if we have time, we visit some weird and wacky American ghost stories. And we end with my favorite part of the show, which is the cocktail of the day. I welcome all the new listeners. We've had quite a few new listeners lately, and I do hope you like us. I do hope you resonate, and I do hope you all end up becoming martini heads. Yes, we're a little bit right-wing, but I think these days that just means common sense. We are spirit-centered, and what that means is that we do not want to give God a word. We know that we are part of something so magnificent, we don't really have the vocabulary for it. But we also don't believe we have to crawl our way to it. We believe we are an intrinsic part of it. We are American patriots, and if you're from another country, hopefully you're a patriot of that country. And if that country isn't working for you, you're enough of a patriot to try and turn it around. What we're here to do, my darlings, what martini heads are all about, is common sense, common decency, common courtesy, not, bring back the old ways. But the world is ever evolving. But what we want is to get rid of this globalist agenda of insanity, which is outright Luciferian, perverted, weird stuff. We're not into the weird stuff, darlings, not on this show, not at all. There it is. Write to us if you have anything to share. We're not going to do quack today. But I'm still going to give you my address because we'll do quack on just about every other show. Please share the thoughts that you have about the world today, the world past, the world tomorrow. Send your emails to me, arnie@arnieavedisian.com, or by snail mail to Cosmic Arnie, P.O. Box 714, Wilsonville, Oregon 97070, USA. And don't forget to let me know if and how you wish to be identified. Or I shall be forced to refer to you as omit personal details, which is, well, it's okay, I suppose, but it's not very warm and fluffy. So, what do we do now? Let me have a sip of this drink. I really think I should take a little sip of this drinky poo and see if it's a winner or a sinner, because this show, my darlings, is where top shelf distilled spirits meet the Holy Spirit. So, let me take a sip. Don't go away, darlings. Sipping is happening. Oh, one more sip, please. That, as they say back home, that is a corker. And more about that towards the end of the show. Now, here's the thing why we're not going to do a traditional quack today. The vast majority of the questions that we had, they were all on this hot new topic around town, which is actually everyone's talking about the lost civilization of Tartaria or Grand Tartary. So instead of our usual quack, I'm just going to answer all the questions at once by talking, pontificating, if you will, a little bit on the two or three little things that I actually do know about Tartaria. So thank you to Mary in Durham, which I believe is North Carolina, to Jerry in Ontario, the one in California, not the Canadian one. Thank you to Dolores in Houston, Texas, and to Vera in Medford, Oregon, for asking me if they should spend any time researching the various theories circulating with regard to Tartaria. For example, did it exist? And why don't we know about it if it did, and what happened to it, and why did it disappear? All good questions. And I'm not sure I have too much meaningful input today, but I am more than happy to discuss it with you, to, talk about a few plot markers, do a little shallow digging, and see if we find any tantalizing clues. So, the whole Tartaria thing came up for me big time about 6 months ago when, seemingly out of the blue, all of my people, you know, the people on my various groups, etc., the people I hang out with, started going on about Tartaria. Come on, Arnie, do a cosmic conversation about Tartaria. Talk about Tartaria. And, you know, it's such a big subject. It's such a massive rabbit hole to go down. I really didn't want to do it. It would have possibly taken an 8-hour workshop to get through it. And my cosmic conversations are under 2 hours, and they're sort of like a little, an appetizer, an amuse-bouche, a little teaser for the main event. So I thought what we'd do today is take a look at the questions that Tartary conspiracy theorists are asking. Now, I'm not going to say I believe one way or another in the whole agenda, but it's being talked about now. And it is, of course, the era of exposure, isn't it? All this stuff is coming to light, the good, the bad, the ugly, everything in between. So it's only a matter of time before we have to go down the Tartary, you know, I was going to say the Tartary egg roll. I must be hungry. The Tartary rabbit hole. Make note to myself, order Chinese takeout tonight. So when one of these Tartary people come up to you, the people who believe in all this, say, how do they start their conversation? So they go, hey, baby, do you want to talk about lost civilization and mud flats and cabbage patch kids that were made in incubators and possibly people from another planet giving direction? I mean, how do you approach this subject? So one of the, I'm going to call them the Tart people. The Tart people, those are the conspiracy theorists, or just the theorists about Tartaria, because there is a great deal of truth to this. They would say something along the lines of, have you ever been to like a state capital somewhere in America, and you see these really very, very grand buildings, and it's so out of place in space and time in, you know, some capital city in Northeast America? I mean, and then you think to yourself, well, when was this built? And they say, well, this was built 150 years ago and 200 years ago. And you go, but we had really very little technology to build these grand things back then. That's sort of how they approach it. In the back of our minds, when we see something that doesn't quite make sense, I mean, we note it. We may not consciously act on it. But these Tartarian conspiracy people, they're really asking some very good questions. You know, they tell us people never question history, do they? You know, you're just taught by your school, by your college, the same narratives over and over again, refined and polished, perhaps by different administrations for, you know, for their propagandizement. But they say it's not actually education. Are we being indoctrinated? So I think it's fair to say that most of us are discouraged at school from asking really important questions about pertinent things, like biblical things and historical references. Well, that's just the way it was, Abedician. Okay. All right. Well, fantastic. Thank you for the education that's going to prepare me to be such an amazing critical thinker. But here's the thing. I don't think this whole Tartaria thing is a fairy tale per se, because it does appear on maps. It appears on older maps, 1500s, 1600s, into the 1700s, but somewhere around the 1800s, it's already begun to shrink. I mean, when you look at the Russian landmass now, and that was all Tartary or Grand Tartaria. And that is not a word we use anymore. So what happened to this great Tartarian thing on the map? Could it be that just the Russians and the other tribes slowly took over? Or some people would say that the whole Tartarian thing is just a loose umbrella name they gave to all the various different nomadic tribes that inevitably moved on or assimilated into other tribes. But there's another theory that says, no, this is about the systematic deletion of a global civilization. And the Tartarian conspiracy people will say to you, it's not just in that landmass we have evidence of Tartarian technology across the globe. They think that these were actually giants, is a popular theory, but they were so enlightened that they were able to generate free electricity. So perhaps Nikola Tesla wasn't really inventing anything. He was just discovering things and being as highly intuitive as he was remembering, trying to save the old technology. Because the whole premise of this Tartaria is that they wiped out an entire civilization that gave us free energy and these wonderful buildings and so that they could enslave us. Because, you know, if you've got free energy and then you're all living in harmony, you don't have to go to war and the bad guys can't make any money. Well, that is a theory I know to be true. So if they lied about our history, which of course they did, what else have they lied about? Which is pretty much everything. So eventually, by about the late 1800s, the term Tartaria just wasn't on any map anywhere. Government-sanctioned scholars, I guess, said, oh, it wasn't really important, and they scrubbed everything from the textbooks and the school curriculums. But, you know, it was there. It was all over the place from the 1600s to the 1800s. Tartaria. And it was not just one mass with the name Tartaria. They had maps that showed cities and roads and networks. So I don't think it was just a label, an umbrella label. I don't think it was a catch-all term. And really and truly, when we do look at some of the architecture around the world, and we're told they were built a couple of hundred years ago, it does seem unlikely that people with hammers and chisels and very primitive steam tools made some of these buildings. The Tartarian theory is that people didn't build these buildings. They discovered them in the late 1800s and the early 1900s. And they say that they were mainly buried in mud, and so they were renovated. It's very interesting. They ask, you know, again, going back to the theory that you have these smaller towns that aren't particularly sophisticated in their architecture. And then you have this sort of colossal town hall or this colossal building that looks like something out of Nero's Rome. Anyway, worth thinking about, worth asking, you know, these questions. So here we are again, back to the beginning. Tartaria, was it real? Well, whatever it was on maps at some time. It seemed to have been a very advanced civilization, which threatened the narrative that then the incoming, what we call the Rothschild, Rockefeller, you know, the bad guys, they wanted to take over the world. They couldn't enslave the world if the world knew about free energy. Because again, if you're not fighting for resources, there's peace. And if there's peace, the bad guys are very, very unhappy. So what did happen? They say it's a reset. They say one morning you wake up and there's a giant mud flood and the windows are buried and the doors are sealed. And everyone told, oh, you know, this is a terrible thing, but, you know, this is nature. This is what happens. And, well, if we really do think about it, though, there are buildings all over the world. I mean, Paris, Chicago, St. Petersburg, you know, name some big old towns. They do seem to have entire basement levels with fully finished windows, etc., below the street level. And you could say, well, you know, street level changes over time, and it does. But something about the architecture doesn't look that way. If we really take a look at it, nothing seems, everything just doesn't, something doesn't fit. I'm sorry, I'm not being very articulate. But once I started taking a look at these pictures, and I've got hundreds of them here I'm going through, it's true, something quite doesn't make sense. You've got all these cities, all these places that have got basement levels, and they look just like the floors above. It's not like they're made as a basement. There's something very odd about that. So if you do go and you Google Tartaria plus mud flood, take a look. Let me know what you think about that. People could say, well, you know, you're saying everything is man-made. I'm not saying right or wrong with any of this, but the people who believe in this, the Tartarian theorists, they say, look, take the Great Fire of Chicago, 1871. When we're talking about resetting things, using earthquakes, that sort of thing for resetting things. How did the Great Fire of Chicago start in 1871? Well, back in boarding school in England, I was told that a cow kicked over an open flame, a lantern, and the city burned to the ground. And that's a lovely story. But if we look at photographs, if we really bother to look and find photographs that have been taken just after the fire, the buildings that are made of stone are in very, very bad shape. And entire blocks seem to be flattened. And something looks more like a targeted demolition, perhaps. And if we take a look at the great floods and the earthquakes and mudslides and all of that, and take a look at the photographs in places like San Francisco, Boston, Toronto, Seattle, Dresden, London, Lisbon, anywhere that was bombed. There really is a theory that these were done on purpose so that we could have a great reset. And then they talk about the world's fairs, which is really actually very interesting. In the late 1800s and the early 1900s, we actually had quite a series of very big expositions all over the world. Paris, Chicago, San Francisco, St. Louis, and other places I can't remember. Really big, apparently temporary cities were built in record time within a couple of years. And apparently they were only going to be shown for 6 months and then destroyed. Something about those buildings doesn't quite make sense, that you could put these Greco-Roman style buildings up that quickly and only to a standard that's, you know, proper architectural standard, and then only to show them off for 6 months and then to destroy them. So the theorists would say to me, Arnie, look, they inherited the buildings. They didn't build the buildings. They uncovered them. They inherited them. They cleaned them up. And then once it was destroyed, then that was another nail in the coffin for any historical evidence of the Tartarian Empire. So that's the mud flood theory. I don't know, next time you go into these cities and you see these basements under street level, just take a moment and really take a look at them and see if something doesn't quite make sense to you. Now, the thing I really want to talk about with this Tartaria is the free energy conspiracy, because Nikola Tesla, who died a pauper and not in very good health, apparently invented all this wonder. Well, we all know the story of Nikola Tesla, but here's the thing. Did he actually invent those things, or was he resurrecting the free energy that was already there? Did he inherit that knowledge? Because I don't think that the things that we've been taught about technology in antiquity are true. Don't have a lot of archaeological evidence to prove that, but we do have some. I'm just trying to wrap my mind around, you know, I'm trying to think how they built all these amazing cities at the beginning of the Industrial Age with not a lot of electricity, with very primitive tools, etc. When you step into some of these cathedrals, either in America or anywhere in the world, we think of them as really grand, and they are. And we were told that some of them were made in the 13th century, 14th century, 15th century by what, stonemasons with hand tools? These intricate, beautiful cathedrals with barely knowing Euclid's geometry. I mean, the ornamentation alone, but why were they built with copper domes and gold finials, and there were mercury balls? So the theorists say that these spires are antenna, and that these cathedrals themselves, a great many of these buildings, were not necessarily for worship, but they were like tuning forks. They were healing centers. They were for harnessing energy from the ground, from the air, from anywhere, from ether. So the whole theory is around Tartaria being electric. So if you go back and you can look at the pyramids, of course, all over the world, not just in Egypt, and we've kind of figured out clearly they all work together. We don't have the capstans anymore, etc. But think we've figured out that these aren't really tombs. We've figured out that these are machines. These are some sort of power plant. So that's already in our consciousness. Now, here's something else the theorists would like us to take a look at. If you take a look at the layout of the old world cities, take an aerial look, a sky look, they really resemble circuit boards. They are these very intricate geometric grids with radial streets and symmetrical domes and towers and spires at key locations. This is not random. This is not just for a pleasing aesthetic. This is some sort of blueprint, some sort of schematic, perhaps for massive transmission of energy. I mean, take a look at Paris, take a look at DC, take a look at St. Petersburg, take a look at Prague, take a look at Philadelphia, Istanbul, Boston, Vienna. Take a look at the radial hubs and the harmonic points. And we're going to talk a little bit about star forts in a minute. They were very, very popular. And surrounded by moats. Now you go, oh, Arnie, I've got you on that one. Moats. They surrounded castles and they surrounded all sorts of buildings because it's a great protection. The army has to make a bridge to go across, and if they jump in the moat, they won't be able to get up. And possibly, I don't doubt that it has a protection value, but also electricity. Water is a tremendous conductor of electricity. So that was very interesting to me. And you wonder if some of all of these cities that all look the same, we know that the pyramids all work together. Well, okay, how do you know that? Okay, I feel it in my heart, darling. I feel it in my bones. I know that the pyramids all work together. They were a network that they were able to communicate with each other all over the place. Why would it not be then? Why don't we consider then that all of these cities that have these circuit board grids all worked together, that they were all actually built to work together? So let's take a look at these domes and spires made of materials that could easily harness electricity from the air. Take a look at star forts. Go just Google it. Go to star forts. I mean, the theorists tell us, Arnie, those are the forgotten power stations of the old world. And it might well be. I mean, they're wonderful. They're fortresses made of stone, and they're shaped with great precision into multi-pointed stars. They're gorgeous. One day they suddenly stopped building them. Why? They're everywhere. They're in Europe, they're in India, there's some in the Netherlands, the Philippines. You see them from the 16th through the 18th centuries. roughly the time that Tartaria was on the maps, and then they vanish without explanation. Were they just military defense? I mean, it sounds reasonable, but once you start going down that egg roll, that rabbit hole, you see other little anomalies. Like, how do they align so perfectly with magnetic north and energy lines? Surely that wasn't particularly important for a military port, unless they all had their own feng shui practitioner, which I don't think. They're not just military outposts. They channeled energy. They could. Free energy. I mean, it's a fractal shape, isn't it? Harmonically tuned. It's exciting. And some of the forts have copper-topped spires. Dead center. That align with sacred geometry principles. And again, with the moats filled with water, I don't think it's just defense. It's a conductor. It grounds energy. It amplifies frequency. It's exciting stuff. I'm kind of getting into it now, now that I'm talking to you about it. Take a look at some staff arts. Some of these star forts. There's a place called Boutrange in the Netherlands. Just Google it. Fort McHenry in the USA. You know, the one that was immortalized in the Star Spangled Banner. It's a defensive military structure, but it's a five-pointed energy fractal. Agra Fort in India. A big, massive, symmetrical red sandstone fort built by the Mughals. But it's... there's something inside of me. There's a word, and it's forming. I think it's a word that doesn't exist in our vocabulary that's going to come through me at some point. That it's this a very uncomfortable but exciting feeling that I have inside of me, that we've come across something that we have to develop new vocabulary for. But I digress. I'm a little hesitant. Oh, I was a little hesitant to talk about this portion, but here's the thing. If this Grand Tartaria was a civilization, which it was a civilization, and if their people were so knowledgeable with free energy and building these wonderful buildings and these star forts, etc., that they started to illuminate the world, if their ideas were bleeding too much sovereignty into the minds of men, I could see why they would want to destroy all semblance of that. And I could see why that they would invent these mud floods or create these mud floods and earthquakes so that, you know, they could get rid of the free energy and instead use their nefarious energy years down the road, which they're doing. 5G towers. ELF wave installations, HARP. Everybody knows it. Tesla certainly knows it. The US Army certainly knows it. The US Armed Forces know how to use these technologies. So they wanted to get rid of all the free energy from Tartarians and instead replace it with the energies that would be incompatible with sovereignty. That's why they injected everyone with this damn fake COVID vaccine and now frying their brains out with 5G. And 5 years ago, people laughed at me for saying that. No one's laughing now, unfortunately. Everyone's crying at everyone's funeral. So, Arnie, get back to the point. I guess they wanted these buildings, for the most part, buried, forgotten. And some of them, if they kept them, they repurposed them. But they needed to get rid of this civilization. They need to erase it. Because I'm going to quote directly from an article here. You can't control a civilization that doesn't need your wires, your oil, or your grid. You can't enslave people who power their homes from the air and heal themselves with frequency and sound. Tartaria didn't just build differently. They lived differently. Sovereign, self-sustaining, unified. And of course, the system, the bad guys, didn't like that. And so they erased it. They stole a lot of the copper so that the buildings couldn't be used for their original purpose. They clipped the antennas and put other signs on there. Even some domes were completely removed. And those magnificent organs that gave so much healing energy were downgraded purely to musical instruments instead of the harmonic healing devices that they were. It was all just deleted. Haven't you ever said, when you look at some of these older buildings, why can't we build like this anymore? Why are all our buildings today made of Tyvek and ticky-tacky and wood? Something just doesn't quite feel right, does it? It's almost as if an entire time period disappeared. Free energy. Think about it, people. Think about it. Now, as we continue to connect the dots, there'll of course be more questions that we will ask. I want to skip forward a little bit to the world fairs, because this is a major part of their theory. From 1850, and with that, I also want to talk about all these children, these railroad children that suddenly just showed up seemingly from nowhere to repopulate cities. But how did these cities get so empty? Okay, big egg roll to go down here. But let's start by reminding ourselves that history is written by the people who win the wars. The world fairs, 1850s to the 1900s, lots and lots of world fairs, international exhibitions, expositions they were called. They were designed as a manifestation of a show of progress, of culture, of technology. But if we look at the pictures, Chicago World's Fair, I think, is the best known in America. If we look at the pictures from the Chicago's World's Fair from 1893, we're seeing an entire city. And the city is full of palaces made of marble and towers and canals, I guess, and statues that look like they belong in Emperor Nero's garden. The White City, they called it. 600 acres, 200 massive structures. And they built all of that in under 2 years. And then they destroyed it after the fair. Does that make any sense? I don't think so. I think there's a different truth underneath this. And I want to dig deeper into it. Maybe these buildings were mainly repurposed. The other thing is, the White City, it was tremendously illuminated. And into the whole, yes, they had electricity, but my gosh, electricity was still fairly new. How could they get that much juice now that I think of it? Anyway, just something to think about. Now, if there's been this great reset, a lot of people died, I guess. And we've got these world fairs. After every world fair, with all their massive architecture and odd chronology, I suppose, and that they demolish everything, having built this entire city, I'm still trying to wrap my mind around it. They build this entire city, they demolish it. And then they erase all memory of it. And then what happens? What else is going on? Now, today we would look at that and we go, this is a massive child trafficking ring, is what we would say. And so we fast forward to the orphan trains. Okay. Between 1854 and 1929, over 200,000 children, this is a fact, were loaded onto trains and shipped from East Coast cities into the heartland of America. Okay, lovely, how wonderful for them. Well, they had no parents. They had no background. They just said, we're going to save the urban poor and send them into the American heartland and put them in good Christian homes. But who were they? Where did they find all these children that they loaded up and put into cattle cars? I mean, some of them, they were all ages. They were little infants. They were toddlers. But here's the thing. They didn't really remember where they came from. So something about that particular narrative doesn't really add up. So are we to believe that hundreds of thousands of children was just simply walking about all the streets, in the mid-1800s, unsupervised or whatever, and abandoned and enough, to fill the train for 100 years or whatever? Where were these resettled children from? Were they sent to towns that had just been flooded or reset? Like Chicago after the 1871 fire, or San Francisco after 1906? Conveniently empty cities with fresh populations with very little memory? I know this sounds really rather bizarre, but the more you go down this egg roll, the darker and darker it gets, because I know for a fact, through research, not because I'm special or I know anything special, I know for a fact that most of these children did not make it to those good Christian homes. They ended up in these industrial schools and in indentured servitude, and they ended up in things that resembled labor camps and orphan asylums and terrible places. And there are even accounts of a great many children showing up with foreign accents and certainly not looking like, or talking like American children. Are we asking, are they the survivors of Tartaria? Were some of these children Tartarians? Anyway, too much detail to go into. Where are the adults? Why did they just have the children on the railroad cars? Where are the adults? And it wasn't just America either. If we're honest, in Britain, Britain sent thousands of children to Australia, to Canada, and to South Africa. They had multiple programs for doing that. Why do they do that? And in Russia, of course, there were the state-run orphanages that were overflowing as everybody was really suffering during the great restructuring, right, in the 1800s. And there are reports from Germany as well that show entire cities with only children in the streets, with no adults. What happened to the adults? So was this a global thing? It wasn't just in one place. So we can only conclude that the orphan trains are not a humanitarian effort, not a humanitarian project. The Tartarian theorists would say this is a population management. That's what it's all about. They needed new people, new seed with no memory that would just absorb whatever they were told. This is very big if you really think about it. Replacing entire populations. If this was done and it was hidden from us, my God, I mean, what kind of grip on reality do we actually have? And I challenge us to actually think back. Now that I think about it, a great many older people, I'm 66, so people older than I, would say, well, I don't remember. I remember that my grandfather was an orphan. So-and-so was an orphan. There were many, many orphans. So what have we got? A few little theories, some maps that generally end up in the Smithsonian. And then what happens in the Smithsonian goes into a very deep, dark room and is never, ever seen again. So was Tartaria a real thing? Was it wiped out in one massive reset? And these children, were they the remnants of that? And rather than just murder them, we basically turn them into slaves. You do not want to read some of the accounts of what happened to some of these children in the industrial schools, especially in places like the Florida Industrial School. I'm not going to get into the whole Satan sacrifice thing, but you all know that that sort of thing is real. So we're left here with this with this very interesting conundrum. I mean, lies, yes, we've all been lied to for years. All governments are lying to us. They're lying to us now, too. But if this entire civilization that was giving, we were on the brink of free energy. Do you know how liberating that is? People will prosper. They won't fight each other. No wonder it was shut down. Once you put it together, take a look at the architecture, think about the mud flood, think about the orphan trains, and all these children that showed up from nowhere. There were even cartoons made during this time period of Cabbage Patch children, children that came out of incubators. What is going on? And why haven't we thought about this before? Probably because it is very, very uncomfortable. Because if we start to go down this particular rabbit hole, then it will only be a matter of time before we realize that Sumeria wasn't the first civilization. And that the history of our planet is rich, but has been hidden from us. Now, fast forward to Göbekli Tepe, modern Turkey, modern day Turkey. They found a site in which they know that that particular site predates any known civilization by thousands of years. Perfect alignment with whatever stars they were supposed to be aligned with. But here's the thing. They found something in there and they shut it down. What is it that they found? Well, clearly they found that our civilization is a lot older than we've been told. We look at the Great Pyramids of Egypt, which actually were apparently moved using levitation and departiculization and reparticulization. We know now that they're not just tombs. We know they're not tombs. We know that they're some sort of machine and also interdimensional portals in there. We look in places like Bolivia, in places like Pumapunku, where and other places where we see stones cut clearly with a laser because you can't even get a sheet of paper in there. No primitive man on Earth, as we thought they were at that time, could have made that. Just absolutely ridiculous. And we look all around the world at amazing places like Angkor Wat, go to the megaliths of Ireland and England and Scotland, Karahunj in Armenia. We really need to be asking more questions about where these things came from, all in general, not just the Tartarian thing, but as we go down the Tartarian egg roll, we're going to have to start asking questions about the beginning of human life on this planet. Every time somebody comes up with the truth, they get erased, don't they? Deliberately wiped out. Fascinating. We do know that there's a group of people, the deep state are just their managing committee, that they are off-world. And they do try to run us as a computer game. But you see, we are sovereign beings. And every time we fight against that, we get smashed down. This time, we're not going to be smashed down. And I think under this administration, we're going to start having conversations about lost civilizations like Tartaria. So here's something very interesting I want to finish up with. Because I'm actually going to teach a class on this Saturday, the 25th of October at 5 p.m. Pacific time. If you want to attend that class, it's basically just a grander version of this. We're just going to explore some plot markers and throw around some theories. But that's on my website on aniavadistan.com. And just go to the Cosmic Conversations page and it'll tell you, how to send me an email and sign up and everything. They really do believe that the timelines were altered. You know, everything in history that we know, that we understand, goes on this linear timeline, doesn't it? A nice, clean path. At this time, this, that happened. At that time, this happened. But what if it's all a lie? I personally think we should have 13 months a year, 28 days each. It makes a lot of sense. If you control time, what else can you control? Let me see what I'm talking about. It's called the phantom time hypothesis. There's this bloke, this German researcher, Herbert Illich. He's somewhere in the 1900s, right? 1990s, sorry. 1990, is that correct? I think it's correct. In the 1990s, right? Herbert Illich. He developed this idea that nearly 300 years of our recorded history never happened. That 300 years of our recorded history never happened. From 614 AD to 911 AD. He says historical records are fabricated and duplicated. And rulers, wars, events were retroactively written into existence to fill in gaps and justify power. It's not as crazy as you think, because we all know how governments work. And this guy is a bona fide researcher. He's not just some sort of theorist. He looked at what he called the glaring inconsistencies of the written records, astronomical data, architecture. He said buildings dated centuries apart had identical construction techniques. Major civilizations supposedly thriving in these missing centuries left no physical trace. Why would you do this? Well, of course, you would rewrite time. You would rewrite time to rewrite your legacy. You would actually put yourself and your bloodline, which doesn't exist, into that false 300 years and create for yourself a legacy. A fake legacy, of course. But then, of course, then you control the narrative, don't you? I mean, let's take a look at the Gregorian calendar. Pope Gregory XIII, 1582. And the church said it was going to correct the drift of the Julian calendar. And it erased 10 days from existence. October 4th was followed by October 15th. And just like that, reality was, it was rewritten. A reset of sorts. And the Vatican would know, because it has the largest collection outside of the one that the Buddhists have. It has the largest collection of all of, let's just call it, the blueprints of history, hiding all of these things. And of course, they have their own hitmen, the Jesuits, who reprogram and do all the henchmen work for the Vatican. And of course, we have the Freemasons and many other hidden hands, let's call them. So this whole thing about Tartaria is a rabbit hole worth looking down on. Because, you know, we think that giants walk the earth, and people laugh at you when you say that. And you would think that there'd be masses of skeletal remains. Well, there aren't, but there are some. And the Tartarians were apparently, or at least some of their tribes, were very tall, which might account for some of the larger buildings and the, you know, but they were very, very tall, apparently. So, but we are beginning to find some of these bones of these larger people. And of course, they all end up in the Smithsonian. And what happens in the Smithsonian? Disappears somewhere. We have mounds, let's just call them mounds, in Ohio and the Mississippi valleys. They found very large skulls, they said could fit over a man's head. They found burial chambers in West Virginia, where they found 10-foot skeletons wearing copper bracelets with inscriptions they couldn't decipher. In Arizona, they found a 12-foot skeleton apparently wearing armor. A mining crew found that. And in Nevada, in the Lovelock Cave, they found massive bones and skulls with red hair. Interesting. And they were supposed to belong to a group of giants called the Paiute. They were giants, and they walked with the humans, or so I'm told from my Tartarian theory friends. These archaeologists, etc., would love you to believe this is just isolated incidents, but I really think that this is a rabbit hole that is worth going down. I sit here looking at all these pictures. So anyway, that was just I hope I didn't bore you. But gosh, people, we're at the age now where we are exposing all of the darkness, all of the corruption, blah, blah, blah. It's inevitable that once we're on an even keel and everything's out in the open, that Mother Earth will open her own little Akashic records to us, and we will be able to see the true history of the human race. This planet was not originally populated by humans. We came here, the Lyrans, the Palladians, were the first to come down and have their little mining operation. And then they brought other people to work, and those people ended up being what we call the cavemen. And we evolved way before the whole Sumerian thing. Okay, thank you for listening to that. Thank you for listening to my thought process. I hope no one out there had died from boredom, but I find it very exciting. Do join me on Saturday night, if you would like, for my cosmic conversation on Tartaria, truth or trash. And we'll see if we can't arrange our thoughts a little better that night. And now, before it gets too late and you all get too bored, a tiny pat of poetry. And this is one that I wrote just the other day. And if you like my poetry, thank you so much. And go to my Substack, Aniavidis in Substack. But let's lighten the mood a little bit and let's write a poem about little aliens who don't do well with Mexican food and booze. This is called The Little Greys Get a Little Green Whenever They Mix Cerveza with Beans. Here we go. You would think they'd know better by now, but I guess some aliens never learn. Earth is temptation, shore leave not allowed. One taste of beer is the point of no return. It started off as space cadet hijinks, young man pups daring to break curfew, stealing shuttles and sausage links, looking beyond the traditional cadet purview. They partied hearty, but it took its toll. Alien bodies are not made for fiesta. All those evenings at Rincon del Sol put their tiny frames to the tester. So much corn and so much cheese and all those beans on a platter. They became addicted by degrees, and that is the crux of the matter. You're just hanging out with your best pal, having some beers with your queso. Then you feel the hit from the mezcal, and bam, your mind is a meso. You try to push through and party harder, but inside you know you are lost. You order a very large enchilada and a salad that's been freshly tossed. By the time it arrives, your mind's not your own. It has traveled halfway to Venus. You just want to sleep. You let out a moan. You think maybe you've lost your penis. And there, my friends, is the sad confession of a cadet who was promptly discharged. Boys will be boys, but why the obsession to do things that mimic retards? Well, my darling, I hope you enjoyed that, because I certainly did, and I think I was probably drinking a margarita when I wrote that. I don't think we have time for ghost stories today, but I promise to have something suitably saucy for you on the next show, and we will be back to quack. We've done it again. We've used up a whole chunk of valuable space time, and all for no good reason. I have not actually finished my drink because it's ridiculously strong, but I'm going to say I finished my drink because that always means the end of the show. And I hope you enjoyed listening in as much as I enjoyed recording it, because I had a blast. I'm sorry if I went on too long today, but I just thought it was important. I always have a blast because this show brings meaning to my sad, sorrowful life. And the cocktail, of course, makes everything better. A big thank you to mysticalwares.com in Mount Vernon, Washington, for kindly arranging the intergalactic distribution of this show. Mystical Wares bricks and mortar location in Mount Vernon, Washington, is a veritable cornucopia of metaphysical goodness. But if you can't get there in person, visit their website, mysticalwares.com. They are the bomb. Online or on location, you'll be sure to give them a standing ovation. Now, I did promise to spend a little bit more time on the cocktails, and I will. Today's real-life cocktail, thank you to foodandwine.com for this information, was a classic killer thriller zombie, and here's how you make it. Now, let me just say, the zombie is a potent mixture of three types of rum, lime juice, Don's Mix number 2, which I'll teach you how to make, falernum, grenadine, absinthe, and bitters. And it is considered by many to be the ultimate of all tropical cocktails. It's very famous. It was invented by a legendary barman, Don Beach, in the 1930s, and his Hollywood bar, Don the Beachcomber, is credited with providing the blueprint for the mid-20th century's kitschy tropical cocktail movement, the Tiki Tiki movement, which I love those drinks. Oh my God. So the story goes that Beach mixed the first zombie for a hungover businessman who needed a hair of the dog before a meeting. And what the man got instead was an easy to sip, but extra boozy cocktail. And when the man later complained that he'd gone to his meeting feeling like the living dead, Beach supposedly grinned and christened his new creation the zombie. Did it really happen that way? I don't know, but it's a lovely story. But to add to the drink's infamy, Beach instituted a 2-drink limit on the dangerously potent zombie, which had the effect of course, daring his guests to try it, and everybody wanted one. Listen, people, I have never not finished a drink in my life. I've been talking your ears off for an hour, and I still haven't finished this drink. Here's how you make it. 1.5 ounces of Jamaican rum, 1.5 ounces of Puerto Rican gold rum, and 1 ounce of 151 proof Demerara rum. 3/4 ounce of fresh lime juice, 1/2 ounce of Don's Mix number 2, 1/2 ounce of falernum, 1 teaspoon grenadine, 4 dashes of Pernod or absinthe. I go for the Pernod personally. 1 dash Angostura bitters, and you want a mint sprig for garnish. Add the rum, all 3 rums, the Pernod, the lime juice, the Don's Mix, the falernum, the grenadine, and the bitters, into a blender. Yes, a blender. It goes down much easier. Add 6 ounces of crushed ice and blend at high speed, barely 5 seconds. Pour it all into a tiki tiki mug or a glass, whatever you want, but I like the tiki tiki mug. And then you add a little additional crushed ice on the top to fill it, and then garnish it with a mint sprig. And for heaven's sake, people, take it slowly, okay? Take it slowly. Now, this Don's Mix number 2, don't worry about it. It's not a big deal. It's basically 1 part cinnamon syrup to 2 parts fresh grapefruit juice. So you can go out and you can buy cinnamon syrup, but you can also make it yourself. You get yourself 3 crushed cinnamon sticks, 1 cup of sugar, 1 cup of water, boil, stir until the sugar's dissolved, simmer for 2 minutes, remove from the heat, let it sit for 2 hours, and strain it into a clean glass bottle. And then the measurement is that you would add 1 part of that cinnamon syrup to 2 parts of fresh grapefruit juice, cover it up, and it'll stay in your refrigerator for 2 weeks. Do not dismiss this. This slight cinnamony flavor really adds a certain je ne sais quoi to the zombie. And if you don't want to make it yourself, just go to your liquor store, get a cinnamon syrup and some fresh grapefruit juice, and you will be fine. Now remember, folks, cocktails are great if they are an occasional treat. If you use top shelf ingredients and take the art of mixology seriously, 1 drink is all you need. And if you are drinking the zombie cocktail, 1 is almost too much, unless you are me, because I love a challenge. I am Ani Mad as the Day is Long, Avedisian. This was Metaphysical Martini, a production of Cosmic Reality Radio, to whom we are most grateful. Mwah, mwah. Until we meet again, stay calm, stay centered, stay sane. And it goes without saying, let the spirit inhabit the human.
You have been listening to The Metaphysical Martini with Ani Avedisian, The Mad Shaman, a production of CosmicReality.com.